oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
It's The Wonky Show. Dead end courses. Has OFS found some? There's a skills bill to digest, some concerns over September, some data issues to look at, and more free speech stuff. It's all coming up.
It is incredibly light on any detail, so we're not really clear how the ambitions that they've laid out, such as they are going to be met. And in an absolutely baffling move, they've pretty much said, we'll tell you later, which I think is fine when you're making evening plans, but less so when you're making law.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to keep their arms inside the car of this week's roller coaster of HE policy, as usual, a couple of fantastic guests. In Bounds Green, North London, Vivian Stern is the Director of Universities UK International. Viv, your highlight of the week, please.
This is shamelessly sneaking in something that isn't really, it doesn't really fit, but I have been doing a steps challenge and I've been walking 20,000 steps every day for a week and a half, which means I think I've walked about 150 kilometres in the last 10 days, which I'm quite proud of.
Excellent. And in Gosforth, Gary Hughes is the Chief Exec of Durham Students Union. Gary, your highlight of the week, please.
In a shameless self-plug, I'm one of those rare part-time postgraduates people, and this week I completed my dissertation into coaching involuntary sector trustee boards and beneficiary trustees. So I'm feeling rather smug, but also have all this free time. So I will start doing a set challenge also. That sounds productive.
Excellent. So we start this week with low value courses. Gavin Williamson has been offering up his views on dead end courses, and OFS has published a measure that might tell us how to find one. Viv, what's going on here?
It does feel, I don't know whether every time I get invited onto The Wonky Show, we end up talking about low value courses, but it does feel like this. I get asked about this a lot. I mean, I find it a little bit draining, isn't it? I mean, first of all, there's what Gavin Williamson said in his, I think it was Politics Home, wasn't it, article, where he sort of lazily contrasted basically STEM courses and everything else. And as a graduate of English literature, I somewhat take umbrage at that. But I find myself just thinking, I know that this has been endlessly debated, and I don't think it's in the interest of the sector to sort of be massively defensive about this. But I do think there are, you know, there is two decades worth of argument about nuance. And it seems to me that the way that things are going is sort of in the opposite direction, away from nuance, towards something that I think is wonky. I think, you know, you've done a pretty good job of showing that it's a bit absurd when you start trying to base measures on things that only exist in the minds of people who put, you know, data into certain boxes. And I think it's not to say that there aren't people who either go into a course badly informed, they don't really understand whether it's going to set them up for the thing that they imagine they want to do afterwards. Or that, you know, I don't think it helps us to say that there is absolutely nothing to see here. And in fact, I mean, the UK has been doing a piece of work on value. Julia Buckingham's been leading this. But I think that, you know, when you lose the kind of nuance that explains the contextual factors that lead to different outcomes, that kind of balances earnings versus the other things that people might want to get from a degree, I think you're heading in the wrong direction.
Gary, you know, if it's the case that in a large university there are big subject areas where, you know, there's a 30% chance of a student completing and getting a graduate job, don't we need to know that?
Well, I mean, I think those are two different things. I think completing is I think there are lots within an institution that we can do to help people complete. I think the measures that we're talking about here is our post-graduation ones, where we're talking about earnings, we're talking about potential, as Vivian said, which has lost all nuance. I think the thing that I'm always mindful of in this debate is that for every person who we get on a high quality, supposedly job to code computers, you need a arts person to create the plot for computer games. For every person who is brilliant at architecture, you need something to be going on in the buildings. And I think actually the simple divorce of this earns money, therefore it is good, this does not earn money, therefore it is bad, really misses the synergy that happens in the world of employment. I think my take on the measure is that we have been talking about this for a long time. I think that Vivian's absolutely right. We can't dismiss it out of hand. But I think the longitudinal nature of this evidence, we don't have 40 years worth of data on this. We've got degrees and jobs that have existed for a relatively short amount of time. We've got an incredibly complex economic couple of years ahead of us. This just feels like a very blunt intervention, but one that is, shockingly for DfE, incredibly short-sighted, I think, given the creativity we're going to need over the next 5 years in the economy and higher education.
Viv, what are universities likely to do with this? So, you know, if there are whole subject areas that have got what look like really low, poor outcomes, what do universities do? Is it that universities ought to be pouring resources into student support to prevent dropout and career support for that particular subject area? Or should they be backing out of that subject area? You know, what are people to expect?
Well, I think, first of all, I would be slightly horrified if universities don't already look quite closely at those courses that have high non-continuation rates and don't perform well in the kind of graduate outcomes measures. You would expect, just as you'd expect an institution to be looking at courses where, you know, in the past NSS scores were low, what the reasons were. And there may be very good reasons for it that have nothing to do with the quality of the teaching and learning on offer. So I don't think, I don't think it's the case that universities are not interested in this. And I do think it's important that we continue to look critically at all the factors that lead to things like continuation and graduate outcomes of a variety of types. I think that just on the, I mean, you know, the bit I guess I know most about is the international side. We did a study about a year and a half ago on international graduate outcomes, trying to work out what happens to international graduates of UK universities between 2 and 7 years post-graduation. And of course, the first thing you have to say is we don't know anything about this. There's no good data for this. And isn't that a bit of a problem? Shouldn't we be thinking more about collecting data that isn't flawed like Leo was flawed and isn't flawed like, you know, Delhi was flawed because it's so close to the point of graduation, which doesn't tell you a lot about the actual benefit of having studied a programme. It just tells you how quickly somebody made a transition from study to, whatever their career path would be. So I think, first of all, the data is a problem. And I'm afraid, because that's not really my bailiwick, I've lost track of what's happening with the graduate outcomes measure. The latest I saw was that HESA was thinking about maybe not collecting it for international graduates, which I thought was rather bold. But, you know, better data. Secondly, careers information, advice and guidance. When we looked at the international picture, my honest assessment is that we haven't invested enough in support for international graduates to make transitions into labour markets that might not be in the UK. So I think if what this produced was a tighter focus on information, advice and guidance, I think that could, there's no way that's a bad thing.
Gary, the kind of design of the market is such that, you know, in theory, what ministers were saying a decade ago was if we give students lots of information, they will go and make sensible choices. But, and, you know, actually, one of the things that's in the covering document for this new PROCEED measure from OFS is this, you know, the idea that careers advisors and the student panel have fed back and said that prospective students would find this data interesting. Is it, but, you know, is it interesting for prospective students, or is it more useful for kind of current student representatives, or is it actually much more useful for ministers that just want to find a way to impose a kind of numbers cap because they don't like what students have chosen in the market? You know, who is this really useful for?
Well, I strongly suspect it's the latter. I think that the thing about any data, I suppose, is that of course it's interesting, but do you have any capacity to do anything with it? If you know a fact, does that change your actions or what you're likely to do in the future? So for prospective students, you can reasonably make a case perhaps that if you are looking, if your primary motivation is, how am I going to earn lots of money by the time I'm 40? then you can potentially imagine an 18-year-old going, oh, this course will do that. The difficulty, of course, is that when they are 40, that is 22 years into the, no, yeah, 22 years into the future. I was a social science graduate as well. That data exists. Is it useful? I'm not sure. If you're a current student, then to some extent, you're already on your course. So what do you do with that data? Have regret? Go, oh, I should have been a medicine graduate. I think it's more likely to be about government wanting to direct the nature of what is taught and how it is taught at institutions, which I think institutions are picking the wrong fight with government in terms of arguments about their autonomy, because this is an indirect pressure on what is taught and how. I think the difficulty, of course, is that the labour market, you rest on the assumption that this data will affect the labour market, that actually the jobs that are created and who fills them and how is something that can be influenced by government in a significant way. Not to put too fine a point on it, but I think the international economy is a bit more complicated than that. That DfE saying we will put pressure on institutions so they stop teaching music or fine art because we have predicted what the economy will need in 20 years' time. I think that is far too complex a world out there to think that a policy choice made in Whitehall is going to have that sort of cause and effect relationship.
It's also, I mean, you know, you look at, I notice nobody is really picking out computer game design as a, you know, bete noire in the way that they would have 10 years ago. I mean, people used to sort of, you know, take a deep breath and say it's outrageous that people are studying computer games at university. But if you produce a whole bunch of graduates who spent quite a long time getting quite good at something that, you know, is, you know, not necessarily already has an established labour market, they go and create businesses of their own. And that's sort of what's happening. You look at somewhere like Dundee. It's a good example of somewhere where I guess a whole bunch of graduates came out, couldn't get jobs, so started their own companies.
Good. Now let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello, my name is Lydia Dye-Stonebridge, and I'm the president of the London Association of Phi Beta Kappa. If you have never heard of Phi Beta Kappa, don't worry, you're certainly not alone. The simplest explanation I can give is that we are a society for the top 1% of students in undergraduate liberal arts and sciences courses, and membership lasts a lifetime. Like any society, members can of course name drop, but the point is really to foster a sense of community and intellectual exchange. In my article, Should the UK Join the Phi Beta Kappa Club?, I go into a bit more depth about what Phi Beta Kappa is and why something like it might help even out the graduate outcomes between those who go to prestigious institutions and those who don't. The point isn't to create yet another layer of elitism, but to perhaps chip away at the strong correlation between institutional reputation and employment outcomes. Given that one legacy of the pandemic might be that more students choose to study close to home, the idea is that the label of excellence travels to the student rather than necessarily the other way around. In my view, this is a fair way to signal strong graduate potential, but see if you agree.
Now, next up. Meanwhile, this week, the government has published its skills bill. So we learned all about the new lifelong learning loan, didn't we, Gary?
Jim, I don't like it when you ask me to answer questions that don't have an answer. I think one of the interesting things about policy is you're
always
interested.
Why have we booked you?
Yeah, well, indeed. But the thing about policy, of course, is you want to know the what and the why. And unfortunately, with the Skills and Post-16 Education Bill, I don't know very much, and I've read it. I wouldn't advise anybody else doing it. Read Wonky instead. I think the intention is really clear. There's a lot of discussion from Gavin Williamson, from Boris Johnson about how this furthers the levelling up agenda. Unfortunately, though, it is incredibly light on any detail. So we're not really clear how the ambitions that they've laid out, such as they are going to be met. And in an absolutely baffling move, they've pretty much said, we'll tell you later, which I think is fine when you're making evening plans, but less so when you're making law.
Viv, isn't this just a case of, most of our auger response is complicated and controversial, so we'll just lift a bit out and then, you know, announce it as part of our legislative programme. Isn't it that?
Well, I mean, actually, I have to separate out two things. One is, you know, UK's official position, which is, you know, in lots of ways quite warm and friendly towards the bill. On the other hand, as a kind of former lobbyist, I do feel a bit squeaky about this. I mean, I think it's outrageous to say that, a crucial element of this legislation will be introduced halfway through its passage through the House. That seems to be pretty, that's very, very badly missing your deadline for your homework. And I think that's a big problem. I think the government should call down on it. And the other thing is, I mean, this is not my area, right? So I know very, very little about it. But the first thing I did when I read, the little bit of background on this bill was Google individual learning accounts. Do you remember those?
Here we go. I should edit in here some of that music that kind of, you know, with a harp that takes us back in time.
Because, you know, it's not like we haven't had a go at this before. And it's not like that wasn't a catastrophic car crash, you know, costing several hundred millions of public money that seem to go into people's back pockets. Anyway, so I'm sure that won't happen again. But it would be nice to know, you know, exactly how they plan to do it differently this time. And the other thing is, I guess that, broadly speaking, I think providing a means for people to, move in and out of education throughout their lives is a good thing. I think that's been a kind of, it's something that our system isn't brilliantly set up to do. I think as the labour market changes very fast, I think you need that sort of flexibility. But I do think that, you know, there are dangers in this. The first is that it's seen as a trade-off that, you know, that the vision is invest in this as opposed to investing in higher education and sustained study, which is curated in the way that degree programs are curated. So I think it's important to make sure that this is not being presented as a sort of way of, as part of a package that will see the post 18 review reduce funding to universities.
Gary, the bit I'm really interested in is they appear in what we've seen to be giving themselves the power to issue not just loans for modules, but also the power to issue maintenance support for those modules. We don't, though, know from any of the bill documentation whether they're going to offer maintenance support for anything under, you know, below a kind of full degree. And, you know, this whole question of whether or not you can encourage adults to do kind of bite-sized, you know, smaller HNC or HND or individual modules, that a lot of that is surely going to relate to whether or not there's any maintenance support if people are like taking time off work or whatever, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. I think there's an established model in a lot of higher education where executive education is something that you'll have a career, you'll do the odd module in strategy or leadership or whatever, and you have a bite-sized bit of education here. But that isn't the intention of the Skills and Post-16 Education Bill. This is foundational level skills. These are people who will access this education in order to progress to do better things in their lives. So the ambition is really hard to argue against. Why would you? It's a good thing. But the thing we know about people who will who this is targeted at is they will need to be released from something else, whether that is the job they currently have, because it will be less likely to be able to release them for executive education, or whether it is because they will be not needing to do employment because they will be paid for maintenance. And that is, I think, an assumption about the way that people behave, which, again, the law hasn't taken into account of at principal stage. And because we can't see the detail, we've no idea how questions like maintenance will work. We've no idea how questions around timing and accessibility will work in the sense of night schools. You know, is this night schools? Is this weekends? Is it daytime? Because if it's designed for a certain audience, the audience probably needs to be the focus of the policy intervention, not so much the other parts of the Act, which talk about localism and employer representatives helping design and influence the creation of courses. You know, those are fine, those are important, but the people who access the course probably need to be thought of first, and they really haven't.
Viv, the other thing we've seen before, obviously, is in the Higher Education Research Act, legislative moves that should have made it easier to offer two-year degrees, but it hasn't really happened. You know, are the changes in here, you know, the kind of modularisation of the funding system going to be enough to address the kind of part-time collapse we've seen?
Well, I mean, I think the demand issue is behind, I think, the 2-year degree sort of failure to launch. I think it's not clear what the demand for that sort of model of very intensive higher education is. I think the same might be true on this front, that, you know, understanding how these proposals align with demand and the way that, as Gary said, those people you're targeting this at would integrate these sorts of opportunities with what they're doing the rest of the time. I think, you know, you would hope there had been a little bit more. I don't know, maybe I'm just missing something that has happened extensively, but a bit of, more of a kind of understanding of where the sort of the demand will be for this.
And, you know, arguably, therefore, what we need is a full, proper, comprehensive response to the Augur review, isn't it? So let's look forward to the autumn. Now, every week on the show, we delve deep into the sector's past to discover stories of how things were and how things came to be. With Nottingham Trent's Academic Registrar, Mike Ratcliffe, here's the hidden history of HE.
So if you look at the Robbins Report, which stands as a marker of where we were in early 1960s higher education in the UK, you'll find that there's a whole chapter dedicated for the colleges of education and training of teachers. Because when Robbins wrote, there were 146 colleges in the UK delivering teacher training, and they had 49,000 students, which is about a quarter of the whole of the higher education sector. And at that point, they were still dealing with the repercussions of some very serious manpower planning that the government had done and planning for a huge expansion. There was talk about the number of trainee teachers needing to go up to 114,000 across the sector. So Robin spends a lot of time thinking about what is going to happen to all these colleges of higher education. There's a concern that many of them are too small, haven't got a critical mass in terms of what they're trying to do. So there's a discussion about whether they should become liberal arts colleges, whether they could develop in that direction. Robin suggests that they move towards having a Bachelor of Education degree rather than the Cert Ed that they have been offering. And the government swings into action with all its normal planning and foresight that puts everything together. If you look at the buildings built by these county architects at this point, they look just like the new universities that are being put up. So you can put the Walsall campus of the West Midlands College of Education next to Lancaster or Warwick, and from the, you know, the shiny black and white photos, you wouldn't be able to tell them apart. They are doing the same kind of thing. They're developing a residential experience for students, but focused on teacher education. But by the beginning of the 1970s, all of this has changed. The James Committee looks at the future of higher education in teacher training, and they suggest that what would be good is to have a dip HE route, because you probably only need 2 years of a general education before you go off and do teacher training. And that would also be a good way for the colleges to diversify. It's a way that they don't have to have the research expertise that you'd expect in the final year. So the dip HE is born as an idea, the idea that you could have a short stage higher education qualification that you could then top up with professional training. So it's the beginning of our first short cycle award. But also notes that the planning forecasts for teacher training have changed quite radically, because people have counted how many children are coming forward and that the teachers aren't retiring. And therefore, there's a major shift in terms of the numbers that they think about. So they shift this idea that they will have about 100,000 down to about 60,000. So this is a tremendous change in terms of manpower planning, probably an argument for saying the government should never do manpower planning again. So the white paper that Mrs. Thatcher puts out, a framework for expansion in terms of education, has to deal with the fact that there are now 160 of these colleges, but they are comparatively small and inconveniently located for development into larger general purpose institutions. Some of them will be needed just for teacher education. Some might develop in other directions. And cheerfully, this being a white paper, some must face the possibility that in due course, they will have to be converted to new purposes. Some may need to close. And then sets about this extraordinary planned exercise, of which you can find loads of books complaining about because it's just done awfully, of deciding which of the colleges are going to close. And they work their way methodically through it. They have to deal with the churches, who are quite important in this area. So there's discussions with the Catholic Board of Education and the Church of England, who have a sense of which ones they want to keep going. There's some thinking about where things are located, because when they were trying to fill in every available area and make sure they had a teacher training college, suddenly that doesn't make sense. So there's some interesting shifts in terms of that. There's local considerations, which college is going to survive, which is going to merge with the polytechnic. So here locally, there are three colleges of education: Clifton College, Mary Ward and Newark. They all are in the running to join Trent Poly, but only Clifton College does. The others close outright. And in Mary Ward's case, this is a Catholic college that's been put out in the countryside near Nottingham. It had only opened in 1969. and within 3 years they were discussing having to close it. Now, they sold the site to the British Geological Survey, so that's fine, the site got used, but these kind of conversations go on, and brand new colleges are just closed down again. So it's just one of those monumental failures. Now, some of the colleges that survive, either through merger or just on their own, are the foundations of a wave of universities that we get in this century. So Chester's and Winchester's and Chichester's, the kind of cathedral town colleges of education. But some of the places that lose their colleges of education have never really got it back in terms of the development. So places like Grantham or Salisbury, they lose their college of education. They never get it back again. They're left with a College of Technology, an FE college. They don't get a higher education presence back again in the same kind of a way. And it's a bit of a lottery how all that works out. But the prospect that the government grows a sector and then 5 years later contracts it desperately is just one of those sad little stories of how we've ended up in our current situation.
Now, September is coming and the press is full of stories of students saying they're upset about online lectures. Viv, what's going on behind the headlines here?
Oh, well, I think what we are seeing is, first of all, it's quite clear that if anybody imagined in January that September the world was going to be completely back to normal, it's increasingly clear that's not going to be the case. You know, even if in the UK case rates are low, new variants don't, evade the virus, the sort of protection that's been built up by the virus, and our vaccination program is complete, the rest of the world is still going to be going through various cycles of, lockdown, and it's going to take a while to work through the system. So it's clear that September isn't some sort of return to life as it used to be. But I think the other thing that's happening is that universities are thinking about what they want to keep from the experience of the last sort of 15 months or so. And it's clear that there are some forms of delivery that are just actually better online. And I think for universities to abandon things that have actually been quite effective and popular with students would be nuts. So I think that's partly, you know, there are two things going on. One is just uncertainty and universities having to kind of put in place some clarity for students so that they, they have some idea what to expect. And the other is a shift that I think will be permanent.
And Viv, how much of it, the other thing that I've read is, you know, this sense that universities are really keen to be able to say to international students and their agents that they'll be able to start next term in some way online. That's easier, presumably, if lectures are online.
Yeah, I mean, we know that international students really, in very, very large part, want to have a face-to-face on-campus experience. IDP's done some really good work on this recently, and there's really limited enthusiasm for anything that doesn't involve at some point coming onto campus, being surrounded by people from all over the world and having that kind of full on-campus experience. But at the same time, nobody quite knows, you know, what the situation in their home country is going to be, what the situation in the UK is going to be, whether there will be, flight availability, whether the red list will be in place and who it will apply to. So you have to be able to give applicants some degree of certainty that the university is going to continue to be flexible just as it has this year, so that whatever the circumstances, there's a plan in place to cope with that. And that's just inevitable. And I might just add that we know there is a big problem with the UKVI intention to remove, the Home Office intention to remove flexibilities around combining online and face-to-face study on a student route visa, because we're going to need that flexibility to continue.
Gary, what's your reading of the, you know, when you know there are a bunch of students signing a petition saying they don't want their lectures to be online, it's a rip-off, blah, blah. What's your reading of that? Is that, you know, is that legit? Is that, you know, they just need to chill out? Is that, you know, they miss each other and they want some human contact? You know, what are they saying?
I think whenever you talk about students, they're saying more than one thing, because there's more than one of them. So I think the difficulty in trying to read anything into a blanket approach is that universities haven't generally been particularly good at offering more than one sort of provision. So by that I mean that I don't know if any listeners will have had a hybrid meeting where some people are in a room and some people are on Zoom. It's the worst thing in the world ever. Don't do it.
It's all very Max Headroom for listeners of a certain vintage.
But you're on podcast, it's fine. But I think the idea about having lectures online, pedagogically, practically, very sensible. You know, it's accessible asynchronously. It's quite hard to argue against some of that. The VC of Leeds has said some interesting things about, you know, why do we do lectures at all? They were efficient rather than effective. Fine, have that. But some people really like that. They like the idea of performance. They like the idea of being able to ask questions and see things worked out. For some disciplines, the lecture is intensely useful pedagogically. So saying lectures should exist or shouldn't exist is a bit of a daft question, because that both those things are true. But when it comes to planning, you know, people planning a institutional response to how do we deliver education here, institutions aren't, in my experience, particularly good at saying we're going to do both. You know, academics will say we find one of them easier, we find one of them more difficult. Students will say we like. So I think there's so much complexity here, and what institutions probably won't feel that they want to do is pin their colours to one of them. So you could easily see a competitive advantage in one institution going, we are the institution of online lectures, because the introductory course material is foundational. It's not going to require you to engage in a questioning sense. You'll view it online before you come to seminars.
You can box set it. It's flexible. Yeah, you watch it on the bus. Yeah,
absolutely. But I think an institution that did that would set itself in a market, set itself out really well. But then why would you travel to that place? You know, you'd have to have a pretty good wider student experience offer. You'd have to have a pretty good understanding of how you engage in the local environment. You could also see an institution saying, we're going to do no online lectures, but then equally you lose a share of the market there. I think the danger over the next year is everybody trying to do everything. I think, were I the government or indeed a VC, I'd probably say pick one, because you can probably only do one of them well, and you're probably going to be able to have capacity to do one of them. So you're going to lose out either way. You're going to gain either way. But the real challenge is trying to do everything badly. I think do something well.
Because Viv, you know, the danger is, isn't it, that we end up with, you know, someone in a kind of in-person seminar, 10 o'clock in the morning till 11, and then at 11 o'clock they have to find somewhere quiet to sit and put their earpods in so they can take part in something online. You know, a lot of it doesn't feel very sort of student-centred somehow.
Well, I'm going to kind of slightly disagree with Gary, I think. And I think the kind of things that we're discussing in relation to higher education are happening in every single organisation and business around the country. I mean, you know, you say, you know, the kind of blended meeting where some people are online and some people in the room doesn't work. I'm not sure we won't find that in 3 years' time we're just all quite used to it. Actually, the majority of my meetings were blended before this, because we quite often have meetings where you've got people in several countries, and some of them would be sitting in my office and some of them be, typically we did it on the phone, although I don't think that will be the way we do it in the future. But I now imagine that a lot of my meetings I'll have, you know, I'll maybe have half the people together physically with me and half the people on video screen. I think we'll just get used to it in the same way that we got used to working in this kind of radically different way this year. Secondly, it's not all about lectures. I think universities will think about those things where, frankly, there may be even greater value in providing it online, recorded in a way that students can watch at their, you know, a moment of their choosing, and then watch again, maybe watch when they're revising, compared to things like, you know, seminars or you know, the kind of educational experiences. You want people to be working together, doing something creative. And of course, there are lots of courses where access to physical facilities will be important. So I think it's going to be a very mixed, you know, there'll be a mixture of approaches, and what people will try to work out, just as we're trying to work out in UUKI how we do this, is what do you need people face to face for, and what can you do better online? But your point about the quiet space is exactly right. Right, I was going to go into the UK office this morning and I didn't do it because I thought, hang on a second, I've got to do a podcast first thing in the morning. It's just probably better if I do that in my bedroom. The house is going to be empty. There's going to be nobody clattering about. That's, I think, going to be a bit of a problem for us. And I suspect there's a design solution to it. I suspect that just as universities have lots of kind of, you know, very sort of sound insulated little booths, that will kind of develop more spaces like that. So it'll be really interesting.
Because, Gary, this is the thing, isn't it? There's a difference between people that have got the kind of space and facilities and training and so on to pull off high flex, where people are simultaneously teaching, you know, remotely and in person. But the, you know, some contact hours, and, you know, even that is a contested term, but some contact hours being online only when you've travelled to a place start to become problematic, don't they, from a kind of, you know, digital divide point of view and a sort of, you know, why did you make me come here point of view, you know.
Yeah, so I absolutely agree with Vivian that I think over time we will find a way of, we'll find a balance. So I think in 3 years' time, I think institutions will find a way to address things like digital divide, like the way that they timetable, the way that they scope things. And I think that is going to be something where professional staff, students, academics need to have that conversation. For this year, though, if we're talking about this September, I think that is too soon and we haven't found that yet. I think the practical questions you raised, Jim, are exactly right. I think the number of students that certainly I know at Durham, who the university has gone to so much effort to try and bridge that gap, but that does rely upon people meeting them to pick up the laptops, to find the quiet space. I think the thing that, as ever in this discussion, we also absolutely miss out on is it is the very human need that you can't engage in that intellect, in the intellectual sense, with your program, with your future aspirations, if you are intensely lonely, if you have no socialized experience, if you are expected to stay in your bedroom all the time and not engage with the wider world. So I think that sense of space and time and opportunity to access those things. What I will say about institutions is that I think the point you made about isn't it intensely problematic if they only behave in one way? I think it is. Now, I work at Durham, which for decades has been predicated on the fact that you have to come here, that there's no point being a Durham student unless you're in the city, because the vibe, the wider student experience, the collegiate experience of which we're very proud, you have to come here to experience that. That's fine to some extent. That's quite niche, but it's not going to survive for the next 100 years, because people want to access the really high quality academic experience without coming here. And we haven't been designed to do that realistically. And we've been on a quite dramatic catch up journey where we're now, I think, credible in that space. But I think some institutions are still finding that quite difficult, and where students want to engage in certain ways, I don't think yet we understand how they will want to do it. So we can't respond, because we have had to do, because we have had to do that at pace. And one thing, we're not very good at a quick response. We're just,
it's
not
difficult, isn't it, Viv, to sort of predict, you know, what students are going to want when, you know, suddenly restrictions are lifted, isn't it? Because, you know, there's one reading of this that says they'll want to kind of, you know, lick each other and hug each other. And do you know what I mean? You know, I've been saying to people this week, we're surely only 3 or 4 weeks away from a provider somewhere having an animated GIF on the front page of the UCAS website saying, you know, all our teaching will be in person, and they're kind of hugging each other and, you know.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think that when you should never waste a good crisis. And this is an opportunity to make things possible that you would have pushed and pushed and pushed and not been able to achieve before. I mean, and you know, I think it is now completely possible to imagine universities putting on an absolute feast of content that brings in the best academic, the most brilliant individuals in a range of disciplines to enrich a course from a range of partner network universities. I mean, I think that the way that this could change, a student might go to Durham, but through a variety of sorts of, online provision, get access to expertise from all over the world in a way that simply would have been unthinkable.
Code sharing.
Why not? I mean, I have this sort of, if anybody gives me a university at any point, I will try and do exactly that. I mean, what about taking, the thing that you're pretty good at and making it the best in the world by just bringing in all the people who are better than you at the bits that you're not so good at? I mean, I think that there's something exciting about that. And I also think, yes, students will want to get together and lick each other. Probably they do that. And that's probably very good for their, their kind of their gut biome. But I don't think we're imagining a world in which that doesn't happen. We're just imagining a world in which that can be supplemented by things that can happen and will only happen because you can do it digitally. I think the other thing to mention is that, the carbon reduction challenge is going to start playing into this. So people are going to ask, why do you want me to travel from X to Y to do something that I could do online? Because I'm under pressure to reduce, the amount of, carbon I emit.
Now, something's been going on with data this week. And so naturally, DK caught up with sector data guru Andy Yule to get across it.
There's lots of stuff happening regarding skills and occupational coding in the higher education sector. Just last week, we spotted something called the Skills and Productivity Board that has released a tender to develop a skills taxonomy to help officials and ministers understand whether or not an occupation is high-skilled or low-skilled or something else. This sounds kind of difficult and arbitrary, doesn't it, Andy?
It kind of does, and it does take us into conceptually quite a difficult space. And, you can think about all the things that we collect data about and that we analyze statistics about. We kind of understand what a student is. We largely understand what a course is. We give subject codes to courses. We kind of get that. And then there is the idea of, you know, occupational coding, and SOC is now very well established. I think the idea of creating a data structure to describe skills takes us to another level in terms of something that is actually quite a nebulous concept. There will be some places, some areas where a skill is very clearly defined. There's a whole load of professions. You know, you might talk about the skill of somebody to remove an appendix, or the skill of somebody to draft a legal document in regulated professions. Then there are all kinds of, you know, professional areas. You know, you could say that bricklaying is a skill, computer programming is a skill. But if you look at the kind of things that appear in job descriptions, there are all kinds of really very soft concepts. People talk about teamwork. People talk about motivation. People talk about creative thinking. And, you know, to create a data structure that will, in a meaningful sense, capture and describe the full range of skills that employers are looking for, I think is going to be enormously challenging.
So, I mean, how would you set about something like that? Because surely you've also got the crossover between having a skill and having a set of knowledge. It's a different thing to have the technical facility to actually draw up a legal contract and to understand the legal thinking that underpins what a contract actually is in British law. How do you unpick that?
I think the concept of skill probably sits on a cloud somewhere between something like subject coding, which is kind of how we describe courses and qualifications, and something like SOC, which is how we describe occupations. How do you go about doing it? There are a number of techniques that can be employed. It's the case that I think that Nesta has done a study by scraping a whole load of information from job descriptions, recruitment adverts on websites. There are limitations to that.
The occupational coding, the SOC coding, the way that seems to be done, at least by HESA for graduate outcomes, is that they are looking at the written free text responses of graduates. That's kind of arbitrary, really, isn't it? I mean, there are rules for the coding. There are structures that you need to follow for the coding in the same way as for the Nesta study and for this new study. There will need to be structures in place for understanding how you get to skills. But at the end of it all, is it really solid enough? Is it really secure enough to start making policy and funding decisions on?
What the Skills and Productivity Board have commissioned so far is a report to say, can this be done? What would a skills taxonomy look like? And could this be a tool to help this broader conversation along? But you're absolutely right. It's an incredibly difficult area. We often talk about, you know, the challenges of converting that free text stuff into some kind of structured coding. And you know, one of my favorite examples there is the idea that there's a huge difference between a temporary secretary and a permanent secretary, when actually the words are really not that different at all.
It's the same skills almost. It's just a different contract.
Absolutely. And so the skills thing, I think, is very complex. It's very nuanced. The other thing about skills, I think, is that it's very dynamic. It's very fluid. Mm. And the way employers think about skills and the kind of skills they need, I think actually that's a very fluid thing, particularly, for example, in areas like IT, when new technologies are coming along, people are looking for different skills all the time.
And there would be an overarching skill, which would be the skill to learn new programming languages. So you've got that skill in developing skills, which is almost kind of very much a higher education thing, isn't it?
It absolutely is, and it's the thing about developing skills. I think is a key thing that comes out of higher education. That I think also for the taxonomy raises a huge question about the level of granularity that you go to, and I can actually see that, you know, you would need to go to a very detailed level to be of real value to employers, but actually you need to work at quite a high level so the whole area doesn't become too fluid and unanalyzable.
Yeah, I mean, I've been slightly negative about this, but we should, I think, emphasize that there is a real value in actually understanding this stuff and in understanding skills needs, skills that are available, and what skills can potentially offer the economy, productivity, and job satisfaction. But I always kind of worry with these things. If you're taking what is essentially a social sciences measure and you are using that as a means to direct funding or to direct esteem, that you're kind of running into a Campbell's Law thing, aren't you, really? That as soon as we start measuring this stuff and using this stuff in that way, it is going to be distorted. Is there any way around that?
So there are all kinds of standards and protocols that the data scientists and the statisticians would use to try and mitigate those issues. But at the end of the day, I think Campbell's Law is alive and well and playing very strong in this space. But I think you are right to say that there's a big opportunity here, because at the moment, much of this policy debate is conducted using the language of subjects. And so we have policy talking about STEM subjects and, you know, policy commentators talking about Mickey Mouse degrees and so on. And actually, there needs to be something better than talking than conducting this debate in terms of subjects. So if we can.
Well, let's hope so. I've been talking to Andy Yule, who is a consultant and a writer working in the exciting world of higher education data.
Wonkfest, our festival of higher education, returns in June. And because of the year we've all just had, we're using it as an opportunity to look ahead. What worked, what didn't, and how can we come back stronger as universities, professionals, and as a sector? And crucially, how can higher education drive the global recovery? It's all about how we build back higher. We'll hear from people who've been at the heart of the government response, like National Statistician Ian Diamond, Vice Chancellors, Students' Union Officers, and literally, and I mean literally, everything and everyone in between. It's online only this year, well, because you know why. But we're working hard to keep the best of the Wonkfest, you know, bustling with insights you can take back to your institutions at the end, and Team Wonky will be on hand every step of the way to help guide you through it. It's all happening on 9th and 10th of June. The programme is out now, and you can find out more and book your tickets at wonkfest.co.uk. And as usual, group discounts and plus and partner rates apply. We look forward to seeing you in June to help us build back higher together.
And finally, as the debate over the government's free speech bill continues, the VC at Essex has issued an open apology over a couple of incidents. Gary, what's going on here?
Well, this is fascinating. I think it's quite hot off the press. There's a report which is substantially redacted. So I am hopefully going to put it across accurately. Essex had to apologise because two events featuring two academics did not go ahead. The university commissioned a barrister-led review to get to the bottom of what happened, what lessons can be learned, and it was released this week with an apology from the Vice-Chancellor. Now, as ever with the free speech and academic freedom debate, it's really important to recognise this happened at Essex with a certain set of conditions and a certain set of circumstances. So context shaped a lot of what happened, but there are lessons that the rest of the sector will certainly usefully take from this, but probably also misunderstand and try and copy and paste from this. Fundamentally, I think there are lessons for all of us, but the key things, I think, will be that the way we assess risk and understand risk when it comes to these sorts of events we'll have to get to the bottom of it, because the barrister-led review found that the way in which the institution has considered its events in the past really let down two academics and has had to lead to this public apology.
Now, before I come to you, Viv, I should say that I think one of the two events in the end went ahead, although it was initially. But, you know, worth having a look. Viv, as Gary says, the thing I think that's interesting here is that, you know, that increasingly, when you've got this kind of freedom from, freedom to balance, the assessment of risk has to be professional and technical rather than kind of either amateur inside a student group in a student's union or amateur inside a group of academics in an academic department. It has to be a more sophisticated kind of risk assessment these days.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that these decisions are so complex. I think in many cases, perhaps not in this case, but you know, I don't know the detail, but in many cases, you are balancing competing legal duties and the scope to get it wrong, or the scope to be accused by very vocal groups of having got it wrong, is enormous. And I think that this could be the kind of pressure on institutions in navigating what are sometimes competing or conflicting legal responsibilities is going to be increased by the free speech bill, the freedom of speech bill being introduced into Parliament. I think that it's just an increasingly knotty area where, I think Gary's quite right, what institutions somehow need to be able to do is learn from each other and the way that individual cases have played out and professionalised this as a decision-making process. But I don't think that it's that you know, that hasn't been happening, because this has been contentious space for quite a long time. I think universities have worked very, very hard to try and navigate what is incredibly tricky territory.
But I think one of the things that interests me in this is that the notion of competing legal duties was really discussed in the report. And obviously, I'm not a barrister, but what they seem to be getting to grips with is that there is a legal duty on freedom of speech. What you've actually got in the issues here where people were talking about its conflict with universities' responsibilities towards trans people was that's a policy choice. And actually, the policy choice of the institution to go further than the law doesn't correspond with the legal duty of the academics to freedom of speech. Now, there's some really interesting takes in the report around, there's a quite damning quote around, the law as people would prefer it to be is not the law as it is. And I think actually people have interpreted in this particular author's view, their responsibilities in equality law in particular. And the author has effectively said, that's what you think equality law is saying. And you've written a policy that goes further than the law. But actually your policy choices can't trump somebody's legal right around academic freedom and freedom of speech, but you think it does.
But that's really difficult, isn't it? Because don't we all want to work somewhere that whose policies go further than the base minimums of the criminal law? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I'm sure it's not against the law to call me an absolute arsehole to my face, but I'd rather my teammates at Team Wonky didn't do it. Do you know what I mean? So it gets really difficult, this, doesn't it, practically? Gary, the other thing that strikes me about this is, I'm not suggesting that the things that are in this particular case about, you know, leaflets and threats and so on were legit, but it does strike me that in this debate so far, a lot of it has been about helping, assisting and clarifying people that are controversial to speak. There's not been a lot on working out what the boundaries are on protest against that speech, right? And that is as important a free speech issue as the, you know, person that's speaking, isn't it? Don't we need to know what students can and can't do in terms of kind of, you know, protesting or objecting?
Well, you would absolutely hope so. The first thing I'll say, Jim, is that there is a perception that students protest. Actually, what we saw at Essex is that staff protest as well. And actually, the rights of academic staff to talk about things that they, only the things that they teach on, is an aspect of the freedom of speech bill, which is underexplored currently. But when it comes to protests, you're absolutely right. I think the difficulty with government policy currently is that the Home Office has a view, DfE has a view, DCMS has a view with the online digital harms. And I don't think they are all compatible. It leads to the conclusion that actually the three different departments are going to pass three different laws, and we're going to have judicial reviews to actually identify what do they actually mean. So the intention in Home Office legislation to criminalise minor annoyances cannot stand against the DfE's view that freedom of speech on campus is protected and the DCMS view that online things should not harm people. At least two of those has got to give. I think this probably leads to the view that the reason that freedom of speech has not been legislated in previous years is it's too difficult. Right to protest is fundamental. I think that for every story about higher education giving a rise to a great research discovery, there are also stories about higher education and students giving rise to great societal change because they said, we are not prepared to put up with this. We will protest. Now, the Essex example where a leaflet was produced where one of the guest speakers was objectively spoken about in ways that were not acceptable. The report says the institution should have looked into that. I haven't seen the leaflet, so I don't know, but it's quite hard to disagree that if a leaflet is aimed to intimidate and harm somebody, it should be subject to a degree of scrutiny. But I think this is why the Essex report could be construed very badly, because that's a very specific leaflet and a very specific example. That doesn't speak to the right to protest.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscription services. So thanks very much to Viv, Gary, Mike Ratcliffe, everyone at Team Wonky that helps make the show happen. And until next week, stay wonky.